artificial sweeteners. Seems to be the trend now, right?
Artificial sweeteners don't have fructose and they don't have calories. So that sounds like they should be good. Well, they're better than sugar, but they're not good.
Dr. Robert Lustig
is an endocrinologist. That is, he's a specialist in the function of hormones in the body.
He has also penned several influential books.
He is a pediatric endocrinologist and professor emeritus at UCSF.
The toxicity of one Coca-Cola equals the toxicity of two diet Coca-Colas. Artificial sweeteners are half as bad.
Is there any way for you to know whether you have a fatty liver without getting a biomarker?
Yeah, it's kind of hard.
Dr. Lustig, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Sean. My pleasure.
Yeah, I was excited to speak with you. As I said before, you know, I've watched a bunch of the interviews that you've done. I heard about you about 2 years ago, and as I was researching about conversations we could have, I ran into one of your older presentations. This might have been maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And one of the statements that you made that was really striking, and I'm going to paraphrase what you said, which is that fructose and ethanol are the same based on the criteria that you have set up. So I'm sure this, for a lot of people listening to this, is pretty shocking, right? That people think about maybe fruits.
Shouldn't be.
Maybe fruit juice. Ethanol is kind of what you put in your car. It's alcohol that you drink. How in your criteria are those the same thing? I'd just love to break that down for the audience.
It shouldn't be a stretch at all. In fact, if anything, it should be obvious. Okay, it's called wine. Okay, I mean, where do you get alcohol from? Fermentation of fructose. It's wine. So for wine, for alcohol, the yeast does the first step of metabolism of the sugar. That step has a name. It's called glycolysis. For fructose, we do our own first step in our own cells. But after that, what happens to the energy in terms of getting metabolized by the mitochondria, the little energy burning factories inside every one of our cells to power the cell? The energy substrate then is exactly the same. So the only difference between alcohol and fructose is the initial, shall we say, alcohol high, because the brain can utilize alcohol for energy and the brain cannot use fructose for energy. So you get drunk. But in terms of all of the downstream metabolic side effects of alcohol, so fatty liver, cirrhosis, type 2 diabetes, all the diseases of alcohol, they're also all the diseases of sugar. And this is the reason why kids get the diseases of alcohol without alcohol. So my revelation back in the late 2000s was that really these two compounds, sugar and alcohol, were, you know, functionally, not, you know, technically, but functionally identical. And so that we shouldn't be surprised to see these diseases. And so when I made that case to the toxicologists at the NIH, they went, you know, you're right. And, you know, I've been talking about this problem ever since.
So could you make the analogy that kids giving fruit juices, apple juice, orange juice, whatever it might be that they're drinking in their elementary school, is not that much different than giving them a glass of wine or a glass of vodka in the way that it's processed?
From the standpoint of their brain effects, it's a little different because, you know, they're not falling over, you know, rip-roaring drunk.
Sure.
But it absolutely alters their ability to concentrate. It makes them irritable. That we see, and there's no question that once the sugar enters the classroom, whether it be the cupcakes or the Capri Suns or whatever, that's the end of class instruction because the kids can't focus afterwards. Okay? But in terms of what it does to the liver, what it does to the heart, what it does, you know, to the pancreas, all the downstream effects, they're exactly the same.
That's wild. Wow. And it's confusing for people, right? Because when someone thinks about fructose, at least for me, I go to fruit. And my understanding from like an evolutionary biology perspective is that we've evolved. So for example, like we don't produce our own vitamin C. So that's why we've been adapted to see the color red because it's like ripened fruit. So we've kind of been like designed to eat fruit. So is fruit bad for you as well?
So obviously this is the big knock on this notion is, well, what about fruit? Yeah. Everybody says fruit is good for you. And indeed, fruit is good for you. The reason fruit is good for you is not because of the juice. The reason fruit is good for you is because of the fiber. Okay? The juice is nature's way of getting you to eat your fiber. Now, it turns out fiber is the stealth nutrient. Fiber is the reason to eat the fruit and, of course, your vegetables too. People think fiber is what you throw in the garbage when you juice the fruit. It should be the other way around. The juice should be the thing you throw in the garbage when you eat the fiber. That's really what should be going on. Now, why is fiber important? What, fiber is the antidote to the sugar. When you consume your sugar with fiber, i.e. a raspberry or an apple or, you know, a piece of pineapple or whatever, okay, but whole, not, you know, put in a smoothie when it's whole, okay, there are two kinds of fiber in that fruit. One is called soluble fiber, like pectin, zinulin, like what holds jelly together. And the other is insoluble fiber, cellulose, like the stringy stuff in celery. Okay, both of those are fiber. You need both, and real fruit, you know, whole fruit has both. When you consume both, what happens is that the insoluble fiber, the stringy stuff, forms a lattice work or a fishnet, if you will, on the inside of your intestine. The soluble fiber, they're globular, they're spherical. They plug the holes in the fishnet. So together, they form an impenetrable secondary barrier, a whitish gel that you can see actually on electron microscopy, this whitish coating to the inside of the intestine. And what that coating does is it prevents the transport of carbohydrates and sugars from the intestine into the bloodstream. And in doing so, you're delaying absorption, you are reducing the glucose response, which is good metabolically, you are reducing the insulin response, which is great metabolically, and because you're not absorbing it early, you're moving it through the intestine down to the end of the intestine faster. And that's where the bacteria, the microbiome are. And they then have more food to chew up. And so you are feeding your gut. So you are protecting your liver because you're not absorbing all of this stuff that it has to metabolize early. And you are feeding the gut because you're delivering it to the bacteria late. So the fiber basically acts as a permissive sieve that lets the food in later rather than earlier. And so that fiber is actually very important metabolically. Oh, and by the way, the bacteria in the intestine will take that fiber and use it for food, because bacteria can chew up fiber for food. We can't, but they can. And they generate what's known as short-chain fatty acids, acetate, propionate, butyrate. And those short-chain fatty acids then turn out to be extremely important in immune suppressing. They keep your immune system at bay. And so they are anti-inflammatory. And they've been shown to be anti-Alzheimer's, for one thing. So you are supporting the brain also. So fruit does all of these good things. Fruit juice doesn't. And the reason is because the fiber has been strained out. So fruit is fine, fruit juice is not. So that's the answer to fruit.
Yeah, it's making me rethink my childhood and how my mom used to cut the skin, and she used to peel all of the skin from our apple to pretty much every fruit that we have. And that's where the fiber is supposed to be, right? In the skin.
No, well, so if you're taking there's plenty of fiber in just an apple. It's solid. Mm. So, you know, there's, yes, of course there's fiber in the skin, but there's also fiber throughout the fruit. When you turn it into applesauce, you have macerated the fiber. Now the fiber doesn't work. Now it's a problem. And of course, when you've turned it into apple juice and strained the fiber away, now it's just like a soda.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So how does that work? So assuming, taking the same analogy, right? So we have apple, pear, whatever it might be that you put in a smoothie, you put it in, you remove the fiber. That's what you're saying. That's where it comes. When you take the juice, you remove the fiber from it. Does the same apply for greens? So if I put broccoli, spinach, kale, doesn't that remove the fiber from that if I'm making a green smoothie?
Yes. So the greens, or, you know, vegetables, they have fiber too. They have soluble and insoluble fiber too. The difference is they don't have a lot of fructose. They don't have a lot of sugar. Okay, because they're vegetables.
Right.
You know, there are a few sweet vegetables, but pretty much most of them are not that sweet. They're savory. So there isn't the sugar that you have to inhibit absorption of, because it's not there. So if you want to make a green smoothie and you want to put a lot of celery and a lot of kale and whatever else in that, you know, Vitamix in order to make a green smoothie, you know, you're losing the insoluble fiber. The blades of the Vitamix are shearing that insoluble fiber to smithereens. So yes, you don't have the insoluble fiber, but you don't necessarily have to set up that gel that I mentioned before, because you don't have anything to protect your liver from. So if you're going to do a green smoothie, you know, have at it. It'd probably be better if you ate your vegetables.
So what would you recommend for fruits then? If someone loves fruits, they want to keep eating fruits. Obviously, fine. Apart from the juice, what are the healthiest fruits that is good for the liver and won't cause as much damage?
The healthiest fruits are the fruits that have the lowest sugar and the highest fiber. And they are called berries.
Berries, strawberries, are very blackberries, good. Blueberries.
Polyphenols, any. Those are all good. Now, the only problem with berries is they have a soft skin. And because they have soft skin, they will absorb organic pesticides. And so berries can be very high in pesticide levels, and that's bad. So if you're going to eat berries with soft skins, the best thing to do is eat organic. Now, if you're going to eat a piece of fruit that's larger, that has a hard skin, like, for instance, an apple or an orange, it's not as crucial that you eat organic. You can wash it, and most of the pesticides that are residual will be washed away. So for soft-skinned fruits and vegetables, for that matter, it really does pay to eat organic. If it's hard skinned, it's not as important.
Yeah, that's helpful. That's helpful to know. Moving on to this related note around artificial sweeteners, seems to be the trend now, right? Zero sugar, that's the marketing label that they put. And then they would end up putting a bunch of artificial sweeteners in it. What are your thoughts on, in general, are there safe artificial sweeteners that are okay if we were to chew it from gum, drink, snacks?
Right. So everybody wants to know about artificial sweeteners. Everybody. Yeah. And I can make it a short answer and I can make it a long answer. So let me do
both. Give a long answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
The short answer is artificial sweeteners don't have fructose and they don't have calories. So that sounds like they should be good. Well, they're better than sugar, but they're not good. Okay? Half as bad. How's that? Artificial sweeteners are half as bad. But half as bad does not make them good. Makes them half as bad. So the data on artificial sweeteners, the toxicity of one Coca-Cola equals the toxicity of two diet Coca-Colas. Half as bad.
Wow, so it's literally half. Yeah.
Okay, but the problem is people who drink diet Coca-Cola think, I can have 10 diet Coca-Colas. So now it's five times as bad. So that's what it comes down to. Now, the question, of course, is, well, if there's no fructose and there's no calories, how can it be bad at all? That's what people want to know. And the answer is because artificial sweeteners have other things wrong with them. Number one, they still generate an insulin response, and the insulin drives chronic metabolic disease. Number two, they alter the microbiome, the bacteria in the intestine, and they have been shown now in two separate studies to alter gut permeability and lead to what we call leaky gut, which leads to systemic inflammation. And number three, there are receptors for artificial sweeteners on adipocytes, on fat cells. And so if they get into your bloodstream, they might still actually cause fat deposition, irrespective of calories or insulin. So there are a couple of reasons to be very concerned about artificial sweeteners. If you are a sugar addict and you are using artificial sweeteners to try to wean off sugar, then that's a good thing. Just the same way methadone is a treatment for heroin addiction. But the fact is, it would be better to de-sweeten your life, your lives in the first place.
Yeah, it's kind of like vaping instead of just to nicker off smoking habits.
Turns out vaping is almost as bad as smoking. We now know that there are all these chemicals in vaping materials that are actually put there on purpose and cause harm. So, people who think they're getting away with something by vaping are sorely mistaken.
Yeah, I also wonder about the psychology of that, because if people aren't aware, and I think this is why these interviews are really helpful, to be aware that these zero added sugars are actually more dangerous, because things like vaping, kids, people that are trying to get off of smoking, they actually do it a lot more. So the consumption that they get is actually way higher than if they know if they're smoking, because they think it's bad. Same thing with sugar. They're drinking these Diet Cokes probably more often.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, and is it a one for one in terms of how the negative impacts of it? So, for example, someone that is consuming a lot of sugar, you mentioned that it's half as bad, right? Versus artificial sweeteners. Is it affecting the same parts of our body one to one? Except that it's maybe less harmful when it's artificial sweeteners, or is it affecting different parts of our bodies?
Well, the insulin response still occurs. That's the key. You'd say, well, gee, we didn't consume sugar. Why are we getting an insulin response? The answer is the sweet taste generates the insulin response. You put something sweet on the tongue, message goes tongue to brain, sugar's coming. Message goes brain to pancreas, sugar's coming, release the insulin. But it was a diet sweetener. It wasn't sugar. Pancreas doesn't know that. It still releases the insulin. And because of that, it still foments weight gain, and it still leads to changes in the vasculature and changes in glandular tissue and changes in the brain that lead to chronic metabolic disease. So anything that makes insulin go up ultimately turns out to be bad for you long term. And diet sweeteners, even though they're not calories, even though they're not sugar, still make insulin go up.
Yeah. In the book, you'd also talk about the tips that people can take to self-diagnose some of the metabolic diseases that they could potentially have. And I thought that was a really useful thing to point out, because oftentimes, I don't know how often people usually get their checkups, but maybe it's once a year. Sometimes it's every couple of years if you're a little bit younger. And I think tools like being able to self-diagnose yourself is really important. So can you talk about some of the tools that you talk about in the book around how everyday people can diagnose themselves for potential chronic diseases?
Sure. So, you know, the thing is, people go to the doctor and the doctor says, your labs are fine, don't worry about it, and they send you out. That's not a good answer. Okay. It might be, but you don't know that just from what they say. The point is that what the doctor is doing is they're reading a set of lab tests against a normal range. So if you have a level of ALT, okay, alanine aminotransferase, which is a liver enzyme, and that ALT is 35, and it says right next to it, normal range less than 40, your doctor would say, hey, your ALT is normal. Bye-bye. That is absolutely not true, and it's actually dangerous. So doctors don't really know what any of these tests mean anyway. They just know to look at it, and there's this thing high, low next to it. Okay, all of that is garbage. You know, you need to know the numbers. So let me give you examples of why, you know, you can diagnose yourself and why it's important. For me, the most important lab test, the one that tells you about chronic metabolic disease, is the fasting insulin level. Okay? So baseline insulin level. Now, if you're not consuming food, your baseline insulin level should be low, like less than 5, certainly less than 10. But most people in America have baseline insulin levels between 10 and 15, and the obese people have even higher than that. Now, I think a fasting insulin level is the best thing to draw. The American Diabetes Association tells doctors, do not draw fasting insulins. I say it's the best thing to draw. The ADA says don't draw them.
Why is that?
Who's right? Who's right? I'm right. And here's the reason I'm right and they're wrong. The ADA says don't draw fasting insulin for two reasons, and both of them are specious and incorrect. The first reason they say is because fasting insulin assays across the country in different laboratories are not standardized. The platforms are not standardized. And they're actually right. That's true. I'm not arguing that. And it would be better, of course, if they were standardized, but they're not. Here's the problem with that. One of the reasons they're not standardized, the main reason they're not standardized, is that cheap insulin assays will measure something else that comes from the pancreas aside from insulin. It will measure the precursor to insulin called proinsulin. So it will read proinsulin as insulin. And so it won't get the right answer. Okay. Now, proinsulin is what the pancreas makes and folds in getting ready to release the insulin. And then an enzyme comes along and cleaves a piece out of the proinsulin to make the mature active insulin molecule, which then it releases. When the pancreas is under stress, it's trying to get out anything it can as fast as it can. And it will release the proinsulin too. And so that will get picked up in the insulin assay. So you will get a factitiously elevated insulin level when that's happening. So you won't get a truly accurate insulin assay reading. That's true. So the ADA is correct there. Who cares? It's high. That's what matters. Okay. And you don't know it, and you need to know it. Okay. And if you got better, if you started actually watching your diet and, you know, taking care of yourself, that level would go down and you would see that. And therefore you would have a mark, you know, a baseline to work off of. So the reason they say don't draw it is specious. It's not correct. not clinically relevant. The second reason the ADA says don't draw fasting insulin is fasting insulin levels do not correlate with obesity. That is also true. Exactly right. Fasting insulin correlates with metabolic health, and there are plenty of normal weight people who are metabolically ill, and there are plenty of obese people who are metabolically healthy. Because the fasting insulin is a marker of metabolic health, it is not a marker of obesity. And that's exactly why you should draw the fasting insulin, because you're trying to infer your metabolic health. So currently, fasting insulin is not paid for by insurance. I'm trying to get that fixed. Your doctor's never drawn a fasting insulin because, number one, they were told not to, and number two, no one gets reimbursed for it. That's a problem. I'm trying to fix that. All right. And so in the book, I explain all of this and why this is necessary. My book, Metabolical. So there's an example of how one can use labs to diagnose oneself.
So your point about fasting insulin is that it will come out inflated because of the measurement errors that may happen in the labs. But that's not the point. The point is not to take that one point in time. It's to measure it regularly, once a year, quarter, or whatever it might be, so that you can see how the rhythm and how it flows based on the time that it's passed.
Whether you're getting better or not. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Okay. Whether you're getting better or not. So, or getting worse for that matter. So it's not what your baseline is. It's what happens over the course of time. Well, in order to know that, you have to have a baseline. So that's one thing. In addition, there are two other lab tests that are normally gotten during a chem panel. So they're easy to get since your doctor's ordering them anyway. It's just a question of whether they're being interpreted. This one called ALT, alanine aminotransferase. It's a liver function test. And it goes up ALT when there's fat in the liver. Now, the problem with ALT is the reference range. Now, when I entered medical school 47 years ago now, okay, the upper limit for ALT was 25. Today, the upper limit for ALT is 40. Now, same assay, but different ranges. How come when I was, a medical student, the upper limit was 25 and now it's 40? And the answer is because everyone has fatty liver disease. 45% of the American public now has fatty liver disease. How do you determine a normal range? Well, you take 10,000 people who say they're healthy, okay, and you do their labs and you construct the Gaussian distribution, the bell-shaped curve, okay, and you find the cut points at two standard deviations from the mean, and you say, okay, that's the upper limit of normal. Well, the entire curve over the last 45 years has shifted to the right. So now, two standard deviations is at 40 from the mean. But who said the mean was normal? Everyone's sick. So the upper limit of normal for ALT should be 25. It should be 25 now, not what it says on the lab slip. So your doctor looks at the 35 and says, well, you're fine. You're under 40. Wrong. They don't understand. They don't understand what happened. They don't understand this history. They don't understand what the test is used for. So there's another example of how you could diagnose yourself without your doctor.
Quick point though. Go ahead.
And the third one is called uric acid. And uric acid is a mitochondrial toxin. It inhibits an enzyme called carnitine palmitoyl transferase 1. And it also inhibits a vascular factor called endothelial nitric oxide synthase, which makes nitric oxide, which is your blood pressure lowerer. So when your uric acid is high, your blood pressure is high. Now, the upper limit of uric acid should be 5.5, but the lab slip says the upper limit of uric acid should be 7. If you have a 6.5, you've got a problem. And the reason is the same reason as for the ALT. Everyone's got high uric acid, and so it shifted the curve to the right. So you have to be able to interpret these normal ranges and know what they mean properly in order to be able to utilize them to actually help yourself.
Yeah, this is confusing for people because
yes,
unless we had someone like yourself talking about this, how a regular person isn't going to, they're just going to trust their doctor, right?
I got to teach doctors. Yeah. I mean, that's part of my job is, you know, educating doctors on what's going on, which is one reason I write books. You know, unfortunately, there are a lot of doctors who think they don't have to read a book because they went to medical school.
Hmm. So within that pressure, so ALT, which is for fat in the liver that can predict potential fatty liver, uric acid, you say those two are generally normal biomarkers that are happening in regular blood tests, right? Those are already included
can ask for. And they're being drawn.
What about fat insulin? How much normally in the US would that cost someone if they wanted to ask their doctors, knowing that it's not covered by insurance?
Yeah, fasting insulin usually runs around $15.
Oh, so it's not bad at all.
It's just not part of the standard chem panel, and insurance doesn't pay for it. But no, it's not a very expensive test.
Okay, and you recommend someone gets that in their everyday checkup, every annual checkup, just to compare how it's progressed over last year.
Yes, exactly right.
Got it. Question around the fatty liver. So I know I'm fascinated to talk about the liver because a lot of people that we've had on talk about the gut. So we've had like Dr. Yizhen Feng, who I know you are also aware of, and people that are talking about mostly the gut health, but the liver is not something where we've had an expert on to talk about. Fatty liver specifically. So unless you had biomarkers like the ALT, which is probably the more accurate way to determine that, what are some ways to self-diagnose yourself? Is there any way for you to know whether you have a fatty liver without getting a biomarker?
Yeah, it's kind of hard. So the cheapest, simplest, free way of assessing fatty liver is your waist circumference, your belt size. And the higher your belt size, the more chance you have fatty liver. So if you're a male and you have a belt size of 40 inches or greater, you probably have some fat in your liver. If you're a woman and it's 35 inches or greater, you probably have some fat in your liver. But it's not specific. There are other reasons to have it, and it's also not that sensitive. So it's not a great method, but it is free. Okay. Right. And of course, there's no way to assess your progress. You know, then you need to go to lab tests, and the lab tests cost money. So the cheapest lab test that gives you the most information is the ALT, like I mentioned. And so that's, and you're getting it every year in your chem panel if your doctor's sending you for your labs. So that's next. But even that's sensitive, not specific. Okay, so there are other things that cause high ALT as well. So again, not perfect. After that, things get a little bit more complicated and a whole lot more expensive. Ultimately, the best way to diagnose fatty liver is with a liver biopsy. But, you know, you don't want people sticking needles in your liver if you don't have to. The next best way after that is an MRI. Okay, a quantitative MRI, or what's known as a FibroScan, is a set of lab tests that will basically, you know, give you some sense of how much fat is in the liver. What you also want to know is not just how much fat is in the liver, but whether or not any scarring has occurred. And the FibroScan will give you that. And that's a combination of a bunch of tests at once that will give you that. So, you know, there's an ultrasound. You can run a microphone over the liver, and it will tell you how much fat is in there. That is specific, not sensitive. because you can have small amounts of fat that will be missed. So every one of the different tests has something, you know, leaves something to be desired. There's no perfect answer, but by far and away, the ALT is the easiest thing to get. Most people have. It's just a question of interpreting it.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, to think about people diagnosing themselves, but I guess the whole industry is backwards, right? I think in one of your books, you said 70 or 97.5% of the budget that's on US healthcare is on treatment, 2.5% is on the prevention. I'm curious, like,
correct,
if you were in control of the healthcare system right now, and you had the ability to take that 2.5% to maybe a measly 10%, 20%.
Yeah.
What would that look like? What are the, what would you envision changing in the education system, the way people can diagnose themselves, that would actually make a difference?
I wouldn't do any of those things. What I would do is I'd fix the food.
The food.
That's the public health effort that I would make. I would fix the food. All right. How do you fix the food? Number one thing to fix the food, because, you know, if we don't fix the food, nothing's going to get better. It's very clear that
actually, maybe that, I know you talked about like Richard Nixon in the 19th, maybe that would be a useful story.
Yeah. I mean, basically we used to eat something called real food and now we eat something called processed food. And it turns out processed food is bad for you. And it's bad for you for based on three precepts and for four reasons. The three precepts are: you have to protect the liver, feed the gut, support the brain. Real food does all three. Processed food does none of them. Okay. Now, what do you have to do to process food to make it healthy? You have to do four things to process food to make it healthy. You have to reduce the sugar. You have to add the fiber. You have to add the omega-3s. And you have to get rid of the emulsifiers. Those four things. Those are the things that distinguish processed food. The sugars causing liver fat, the lack of fibers leading to systemic inflammation and high glucose and insulin responses. The omega-3s are necessary for suppression of inflammation and neural transmission. And the emulsifiers are leading to gut inflammation and leaky gut metabolic syndrome. So we have to fix the food. Now, how do we fix the food? Well, the first thing is, don't make ultra-processed food so cheap. Well, what makes ultra-processed food so cheap? The answer, the subsidies. The only reason the food industry can offer ultra-processed food cheaply is because all of the ingredients, all of the foodstuffs that go into ultra-processed food are all subsidized. Corn, wheat, soy, sugar. All the things that are killing us. So the first thing I would do is I would do away with food subsidies. What that would do is that would make real food more in line price-wise with processed food. And then ultimately the goal is to deliver real food into the hands of people and make that convenient and easy, and as easy as ultra-processed food. That's what has to be done. We have to push people and we have to pull people. And as long as the subsidies are in this place, we can't do either of those things. So if I had a magic wand, then the first thing I would do is I would get rid of all food subsidies.
Which are the ones that you mentioned? Sugar, omega, emulsifiers, and fiber. Which of those do you think, I think I got those orders wrong, but which of those do you think is easiest to eliminate from the bad ones?
Well, without question, getting rid of the sugar is the easiest thing to do because that's the thing the food industry is adding for its own purposes. Now, the problem is if you take the sugar out of ultra-processed food, it tastes like cardboard. And the food industry knows that, which of course is why they added it in the first place. But if you took the sugar out of the ultra-processed food, maybe people wouldn't like it so much, because after all, sugar is addictive. So you're basically reducing their addiction, and that would be a good thing. Fiber, though, as I've mentioned before, limits the absorption of the sugar. So having the fiber in the food is good. The problem, of course, is that fiber is not freezable. Fiber, you know, means that the food's going to go rancid faster. Okay? Fresh food, you can have fiber in. But if you're going to put stuff on the shelf, you know, you got to basically remove the fiber. I am the chief medical officer of a company, a fiber company, a company that makes a proprietary fiber, a soluble-insoluble fiber mix. The company's name is BioLumen, B-I-O-L-U-M-E-N, and the product that we now have on the market is called Munch Munch. I hate that name, but that's the name.
What is it?
That's what the marketers came up with, Munch Munch, and it turns out what Munch Munch is it's a microcellulose sponge, 7 microns in diameter, the size of a red blood cell. Really, really small. Okay. Flows like a powder. It's colorless, odorless, textureless, tasteless. You can add it to any food and not know it's there. So you can add it to chocolate. You can add it to bean dip. You can add it to ice cream. You can add it to yogurt. You can add it to microwave lasagna. You can add it to virtually anything. Okay. And not know it's there. And what happens is you swallow it, the sponge starts expanding in the stomach 70-fold, and that gives you a feeling of fullness, which is good in terms of trying to prevent, too much food intake. And when the sponge expands, the little nooks and the crannies in the sponge become obvious, and embedded in those nooks and crannies are a set of proprietary hydrogels, soluble fiber. All food. Every single one of these things is food. Every single one of these things are things that are found in food that you eat. It's just that no one food has all six. Okay. So we that's what we did. And what happens is those hydrogels sequester, they soak up, like a bounty towel, glucose, fructose, sucrose, simple starches, rendering them unavailable for early absorption. And in doing so, you can keep your glucose response low. You can keep your insulin response low. And because you're not absorbing, you're protecting your liver. And the fiber is moving it further down the intestine to where the bacteria are. The end of the intestine is where the bacteria are, the microbiome is. And so the microbiome will chew it up for its own purposes. Thus, you are feeding the gut. You are protecting the liver and you are feeding the gut. And then the gut turns the soluble fiber into short-chain fatty acids, which then protect the brain, support the brain. So you are you are basically adding fiber back when the food industry took it out. What we are doing is we are turning apple juice back into apples in the intestine.
Just to get a clarification, the gel that you're putting into your juice, your ice cream, whatever it might be, your salad, what is the actual thing? Is it like a liquidy gel that is coming into like a toothpaste tube or what?
No.
What is the actual?
It's a powder.
It's a powder.
It comes in a sachet, just like a like an artificial sweetener, a little, paper, wrapper, and you just, tear it open. And you can either add it to your food. Ultimately, our goal is to sell it to food companies and have them incorporated into their ultra-processed food offerings. So that says BioLumen inside.
That's so smart. Wow.
So that's a way. And we have clinical trial data showing that people benefit from this.
Yeah. And that's super interesting. Super interesting. I want to go back a little bit, and I'm going to put that link down as well. Can people purchase that, by the way?
Yeah, absolutely. You can get it at munchmunch.shop. M-O-N-C-H-M-O-N-C-H.shop.
And does it tell you, based on how much sugar or fructose you might be eating, how many packs of fiber you need based on if you're eating ice cream versus salad?
What we say is it's 1 teaspoon per packet, and one teaspoon is 4 grams, and each gram will sequester 6 grams of carbohydrate. So a 1 teaspoon dose will sequester 24 to 25 grams of carbohydrate.
Yeah.
And that's enough for each meal.
Got it. Related point around kind of how our body processes things. I know you talk about cortisol and stress a little bit. I want to dig deeper into how cortisol and how much we can control that, how that affects how we absorb, let's say, the fructose that we eat, or how that affects pretty much anything that we eat. Is there a big impact there? And is there a big incentive for people to control their stress based on how it impacts our body and based on the foods that we eat?
So cortisol is extraordinarily important in terms of disease promotion and prevention, without question. But cortisol is not about food. Cortisol, the stress and the cortisol is driving visceral fat, but it's not about food. You will drive that visceral fat irrespective of what you eat. And the reason we know this is because you can take patients with endogenous clinical depression, major depressive disorder, suicidal ideation, people who need to be admitted to the hospital to save them from themselves, you know, for fear of suicide, okay? People who are absolutely, you know, done with life, okay? You admit them to the hospital. They are anhedonic. They don't want to eat. They derive no pleasure from eating. They are losing weight. You stick them in a scanner, and they are gaining visceral fat. They are losing subcutaneous or big butt fat because they're not eating. They are gaining visceral fat because of the cortisol. So the food's not generating the visceral fat. The cortisol is generating the visceral fat. And the visceral fat's bad for you. Okay, more visceral fat, more chronic metabolic disease. So stress is the driver of visceral fat. Food is the driver of subcutaneous fat, and sugar and alcohol are the driver of liver fat. So if you are stressed, you still have a problem, irrespective of what you eat. Now, if you're stressed and you're eating too, which of course most people are, because really it's about anxiety, it's not about depression. Depression is about the past and anxiety is about the future. They are not the same thing. Okay, of course, a lot of people with anxiety will end up with depression, but they are not the same. Point is, if you are anxious, you will probably eat in an attempt to try to lower your stress level. Okay, it will try to basically placate your amygdala by activating the nucleus accumbens, the reward center, which then sends a message to the amygdala, calm down. So anxiety promotes stress, which promotes food intake. And what you will end up with is you will end up with both increased subcutaneous fat because of the extra calories, the food, and you will also end up with increased visceral fat because of the cortisol. So you end up doing double duty damage.
Got it.
So it's stress reduction is absolutely essential, and that's complicated. And it depends on what the cause of the stress is. And it depends on who you are, because it's really not stress, it's response to stress that matters.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, because two people undergoing the same stress, one will react very differently from another.
Okay. So it's all a personalized thing.
It's personal.
I know we don't have much time, but I want to dig into, as my last question, some of your predictions on the future trends of health and what the next 10, 20, 30 years could look like. I'm sure you'll have a big impact there. But for example, like one I have is, I think more people will have what I think are like farm sharing. For people that want to eat grass-fed meals or have the ability to actually see, touch, and feel the food that they're eating, I could see that in 10 years there's going to be a company where, or even maybe local people can, 20 people, 30 people will share in a farm that they can actually invest into, and they can share the food locally.
I don't know. I mean, that's the way it used to be. We used to have communes, you know, just like that.
Yep.
It's hard to know the answer to that. The trend I see is for wearables. I see everybody now wearing something that tells them, you know, something about themselves. You know, for instance, you know, heart rate or oxygen consumption or, you know, blood glucose, you know, continuous glucose monitors. And we're going to see more and more channels developed. The important thing is to figure out how to integrate all that information and how to disseminate it to the public in a way that they can actually understand it and use it, which we have not done yet. So that's the first thing I see. The second thing, which I'm very happy to be part of, is the changing in the food. Okay. It's, you know, taken a long time. The food industry has been in control for the last 60 years, but ultimately people are demanding better food, especially young people. And they realize it's the old food that was killing their parents. Okay. And it's time to fix it. And, you know, we now have the precepts. We now have the data to be able to do that. So I anticipate a major change in the global food system over the next 10 years. Clearly, the global food system we have right now is not working. And, not only is it contributing to health and economic disaster, but it's contributing to environmental devastation as well. So we have to solve this. So that's what I see as the big kahuna in terms of changes over the next 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited to see how the company does. I forgot the name of it. Munch Munch?
Well, the company is BioLumen and the product is Munch Munch.
Munch Munch. Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll be sure to have that link below.
It's Munch Munch. It's with an O, not a U. Munch Munch.
I got to talk to your marketing team.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to keep that name or not, but.
It wasn't their finest hour, in my opinion, but I didn't have any say in the matter.
This is going to be like Google. Google is not a good name, but the product was so good, it just became its own thing.
Yeah.
So I'm sure the product will speak for itself.
Maybe so. I hope you're right.
Well, Dr. Lustig, thanks so much for coming on the show. Where can people find you? And I want to make sure people check out your book.
Yeah, I'm easy to find.
Robert Lustig on Google.
RobertLustig.com is an easy place to find me. And their web, you know, and then there are links to various other things that I do. Metabolical.com is the book, and biolumen.tech is the company BioLumen. I am also the chief medical officer of a recommendation engine called Perfect, and people should know about this. It's called perfect.co. So http://, perfect.co. And what it does is it shows you the things in the grocery store that are healthy for you. Not for anyone else, just for you.
Yeah.
So it's a step in personalized nutrition. And then you can basically order via Instacart from only the healthy options. So that's good way to do this as well.
Yeah, I see, I just checked it out, munchmunch.shop, and I see your video right in the front there.
Looks cool.
I'm gonna definitely order some right now. So,
all right.
Can't wait to check it out. All right, Dr. Lustig, thanks so much for coming on the
show. Thank you, Sean.
And appreciate your time.
My pleasure.